hope now that you can make the link with slide number 3 of our first lecture, when I showed you the chain of approaches, starting with the social level, the behavioral level, and then we slowly go down to the structure of the brain, and we were discussing quite essential ins and outs concerning the relationship between those layers. And to make it clear, we were discussing about metabolic disturbances like PKU and congenital hypothyroidism. Both have a genetic plan. And if the plan is fulfilled, then it for sure will lead to mental retardation, among others. But due to the fact that there is intervention possible, the plan can be changed in that sense, which is victory of science, I would say. And I think that the Down syndrome could be the next candidate. If scientists are able to understand the mechanisms behind Down syndrome, then people come slower and slower to these insights, then it could also return into a group of people with Down syndrome and at the same time have, obtained skills to a certain level. Innate is not innate. And vehicle, which is of course a very important operational factor, is cognition. We were talking in the second lecture about 4 different levels of learning, and learning makes it possible to adjust to environmental pressure and at the same time maybe also changing the environmental pressure into a certain direction. So learning is a key, and that is why, for instance, in psychology, it became a victory that at a certain moment, already a long time ago, the IQ test was introduced. So that is an important achievement in science, to measure IQ levels, and also from this perspective that it helps with respect to the important link between environment, nurture, and nature. Then we started to talk about environmental factors. Do they change the structure? Those factors are changing the functional operations of the brain? And the answer was yes. We were talking about enriched environment versus deprived environment, isolation. Think about those adoptees from Romania. And we were talking about fetal alcohol syndrome and also about ADHD in relation to stress reported by parents. So we have discussed quite important environmental factors which might compromise the brain structure, or that learning itself may improve brain functioning. A classical example, not discussed so far, is one study done in London, where taxi drivers were taking part in that experiment, and the experiment was focused on the volume of the hippocampus. And the hippocampus, in turn, is traditionally related to memory functioning, and it showed that those taxi drivers who have a very good memory, because of, especially in the past, they were able to find their way in a million city like London, and that study showed that the volume of the hippocampus was more pronounced when they were longer doing that type of work. So there are positive effects, there are negative effects. And now we are arrived at the family functioning. How is the family functioning with genetic factors producing psychopathology? So the lecture of today is families and severe disorders. And I have chosen for focusing more today on cerebral palsy. One of the reasons is that we were involved in research concerning cerebral palsy and family factors here in Finland some years ago, and it resulted in a dissertation of a student about this subject. First of all, I would like to introduce you some in and outs of cerebral palsy. And it will show again that the relation between brain structure and behavior is not that easy. So remember again that slide number 3, going from behavior to the brain, that we have reductionism, which means that we can translate all the levels to lower levels, but it is not that easy. So cerebral palsy. The first thing you read here is that it is an umbrella term covering a group of non-progressive but often changing motor impairments secondary to lesions or abnormalities of the brain arising. What does it mean, non-progressive? Well, when we talk about Parkinson's disease or Huntington's disease, then those diseases are progressive, which means it starts and it becomes worse and worse with respect to the outcome at the behavior level. Non-progressive means that in principle, there is a problem, cerebral palsy, but it is not making things worse other than that the patients are growing into the deficit. So you must imagine that when a child with suspected cerebral palsy is born, we come to that issue a little bit later, then by definition, due to the age, the child doesn't speak, the child doesn't walk, so the characteristics of cerebral palsy becomes clear when children, normal children, are reaching a milestone, for instance, starting to talk, starting to walk, and that in these cases it is to a lesser extent possible. So it is non-progressive, but the way it presents itself, cerebral palsy, can become worse and worse, and that phenomenon could be best explained in terms of growing into deficit. So I have explained now the concept of non-progressive, often changing motor impairment. What do I mean by saying that? That the motor impairment is also dependent on the level of motor skills the subject has achieved. That's what we mean by saying changing motor impairments. So it may start, the motor impairment, by problems with feeding. Maybe you don't understand it at the moment, but you need all kinds of motor skills in order to be feeded. You need your muscles. You need to swallow. It needs all kinds of muscle strength to do that. Do you know, by the way, that one very classical index of motor, or no, of development as such, is when a child, a baby, is drinking out of using a bottle, and you try to take that bottle out of the child's mouth. The more resistance the child is given, the healthier it is. So resistance is not always a negative quality. So motor, it might start with feeding. Then another issue is you may not think about is toileting. Also going to the toilet and what you are doing over there. What you're doing over there, it needs also muscles. And there are children who have really problems with going to the toilet and are doing their biological needs in the toilet. They must be helped by the caretakers, which may lead, of course, to parental load on the problem. But these issues are to discuss in more detail a little bit later. And here you read that cerebral palsy is related to lesions or abnormalities of the brain arising in the early stages of development. Well, this is true in the sense that the brain is always operational. When you talk, when you go to the toilet, when you are sleeping. But nevertheless, this is a complicated matter. The cerebral palsy, how it expresses itself with respect to the brain lesions. I come to that a little bit later. And here you can see that there is a new definition. Motor disorder is emphasized, but other developmental disorders may accompany it. So it means that children with cerebral palsy, they may also be ADHD. They may also suffer from autism. They may also suffer from dyslexia, language problems, besides the motor problems. So again, it is an umbrella term. So when it comes to cerebral palsy, there are different types to distinguish. Some people have problems with moving the left side of the body, or the right side, or the upper part, or the lower part. And also it is an umbrella term with respect to so-called comorbid problems. Some may have ADHD, others may have autism. So this is a very broad description of cerebral palsy. And here you can see all kinds of ads those children may have in order to survive, to move, wheelchair, special shoes, etc., etc. Something about the prevalence. The prevalence is connected, inversely connected, with birth weight. What does it mean, inversely connected? It means, among all others, that the prevalence rate as such has remained the same over the years, in spite of the fact that experts are very busy in trying to prevent cerebral palsy by means of all kinds of medication or operations before the children are born or after they are born. So on the one hand, based on the knowledge base of the medical science, we could expect that the prevalence becomes lower and lower, but that is not the case because the same medical science is able to keep children alive when they have a very low birth weight. I mean, once it was going to death, but nowadays, even children with a birth weight of 750 grams could remain alive. This is connected. The lower the birth weight, the higher is the chance to develop cerebral palsy, and that is why it is inversely connected. And as an end result, the prevalence remains about the same. The evidence of the motor impairment appears at age range of 0 to 18 months. So children directly after birth, they are checked by an expert, a child pediatrician, for instance, and then the child is put on a table to see whether the child is able to sit with some help, whether he has a muscle tonus or not. When the child is falling down, then it could be a case who is developing cerebral palsy. There are, of course, more tricks to see what the status, what the motor status of a very young child is. And the diagnosis is usually taking place at the age of 2 years, but also it can be diagnosed earlier. It depends on the severity. It depends on where you are living. What are the difficulties? Well, I already have explained it to you a little bit. Feeding problems because of the muscle tonus is too low. Excessive crying. So children may experience a lot of pain. And then also all kinds of gastroendocrinological problems. When we talk about gastro problems, then we may think about toileting. I have already explained to you. Then, of course, the motor problems and maturation of the motor abilities. And, of course, it leads to defective coordination of movements and irregular defective of muscle tonus. What are the causes? Well, unfortunately, there is not a full understanding of the causal pathways and mechanisms. But there is at least, it's more than a theory, it is simply an empirical finding that there are symmetrical cysts. And what is a cyst? That means that in the brain, where you expect to find structure, white structure, or gray structures, there is, in fact, yeah, so to speak, nothing except some fluid. So we can say that a cyst is a hole instead of material, and it is symmetrical. So at the one side and at the other side, and especially in the parietal or occipital regions, in this part of the brain. And there is a lot of research going on devoted to which cysts on what places and to what extent the cysts are present are predicting cerebral palsy. Well, this is of course a matter for pediatricians, child neurologists, radiologists. They have every year their meetings, and they are mostly interested in the structure of the cysts in relation to predicting cerebral palsy. What makes that type of research complicating? That the site of the lesion is not always correlating exactly with the type of the motor dysfunction. So here it starts the complication between structure and function. So to make things easy, you may expect that when you have, let's say, a lot of lesions at the right side of the brain, that the left part of the body is complicated. And vice versa, when you have problems in terms of the amount of cysts in the left part of the brain, that the right part of the body is compromised. But that is not the case. So bilateral white matter lesions, especially at the periventricular areas, I come to that later, that do not always lead to spastic diplegia, which means that both sides of the body is involved. You expect that on the basis of bilateral lesions. So when the two hemispheres are compromised, we may expect that both sides of the body are involved. That is not always the case, showing and mirroring that the relation brain versus skills versus performance is not a one-to-one situation. And there are also cases with unilateral lesions, which means that one part of the brain is compromised, that in spite of that, what is shown is spastic hemiplegia. That is what you expect, but it could be the case bilateral white matter lesions. It is even so that in quite an amount of cases, I think around 15 to 20%, if I'm correct, of the cases, they develop cerebral palsy, and the experts are not able to show at the brain level those cysts, for instance. So that is a huge amount of people. And therefore, one of the discussions between the experts is that some experts are saying what we need is an objective definition of cerebral palsy, an objective diagnosis based on the quality of the brain structure. And other experts are saying we wish that it would be possible because there are quite an amount, number of cases in which, and now I repeat myself, in which no anomalies at the brain level are found, and then nevertheless people are developing cerebral palsy. This said, of course, in many cases, there is a relation, and then it seems that different regions of the brain are vulnerable at different gestational ages. Then you read here that how do those cysts develop? Well, it might be vulnerable to hypoxic ischemic insults. What does that mean? Hypoxic means that in the brain needs blood, it needs oxygen. But when there is an insult somewhere, then that part of the brain could be without lack of blood, lack of oxygen. And that is what this term means. And that could be the result of problems during the delivery, that brain insults might be caused because all kinds of problems when a child is going to be delivered. And of course also blood circulation problems might result to this problem, which in turn leads to CP. Now, the damage is most of the time when it is found in the white matter around the lateral ventricles. And I will show you two a little bit later. Yeah, how to measure those cysts? How do we measure the quality of the brain structure in very young children? In fact, there are two methods. Here we read the term MRI, and that is a way to measure the volume of structures in the brain. So it is not a functional measure, but it is a structural measure. And some experts are very much in favor of using MRI. Other experts are much more in favor of using the ultrasound. And the ultrasound is, let's say, a small machine. It is comparable to a machine men are using when they don't want to have a mustache or a beard. You put that machine on the belly of a pregnant woman, and it gives you then information about, for instance, brain structures. This is, let's say, more easy tool to use. It's not painful. And if we have to compare to MRI, this is much more complicated. So there is a dispute going on between experts. Some are in favor of MRI, others are in favor of the tool I have just explained to you, the ultrasound. This is more painful, but more precise, and this is more easy. This case, the severe cases are in using both methodologies are detected. So that is, one argument in favor of ultrasound, that the most severe cases suffering from cerebral palsy are detected anyhow using U.S. ultrasound or MRI. But this is a dispute. How to objectify the ultrasound findings. And one way to do that has been achieved by a scholar. She's from the Netherlands, and she's called De Vries, and she has published in those times already about the ultrasound findings. It consists out of three levels. Mild level, which means that it could be go away, the phenomenon, and it is taking place more than a week. Then we have moderate cysts, and they may have here 2 or 4 millimeters large. And here we have big cysts, which are more than 5 millimeters. And we talk also about severe when the cystic changes are in many areas of the brain in comparison to here, where it is in 1 or 2 brain areas. You must imagine that those radiologists, the experts in this field, they may disagree. So what happens when you are a researcher and you want to publish an article about cerebral palsy? Then you need, let's say, 3 opinions of 3 radiologists. And the empirical finding is that in some cases, some of those experts are saying we deal here with a moderate case, whereas others, observing, studying the same material, come to severe cysts or vice versa. So there is not always agreement between those radiologists who are observing the index of the amount of cysts. And I say this to you to underline that some people might think that the lower you are in your measurement, and we are very low, we are here talking about structures of the brain, that you see that it is not so well defined as you may think. So I repeat myself, there are 15 to 20% of the cases who develop cerebral palsy, some very severe forms, without cysts can be detected in their brains. And when cysts are detected in the brain, then still you see that people, experts, may disagree in how to classify the cases. And here you see a part of the brain which is normal studied by radiologists, child pediatricians, and this is mild form, and we as non-experts, we don't see anything. And here we have a moderate case, small cysts, and here you can see this is a matter of millimeters, and maybe 2 millimeters. Here you see, when you have a trained eye, some cysts. And here, it really becomes visible. And also here. and also here. So, to repeat a little bit the issue, predicting cerebral palsy, ultrasound versus MRI. The ultrasound is easy to apply versus MRI. So the MRI is more precise, and overall the correspondence between the two meshes is low. But in the severe group, the correspondence is high.
I have a question.
Yes, okay.
An MRI, wouldn't that damage, because if someone is pregnant, you cannot have MRI or X-rays, correct? Because it damages
these the... These are born children.
Ah, you're okay. Yes.
Yeah.
And also, it could be very hard to do an MRI if someone has cerebral palsy because of the movement, the motor.
Yeah. But these are all children who are born. Look, for instance, MRI findings. So this is a normal situation, symmetrical. And here we have the cysts, and the fluid is, let's say, harming, it gives pressure to those ventricles. Okay, look, 8 months of age.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Now we have discussed, of course, in a nutshell, some in and outs of cerebral palsy. And again, for us, it was us, I mean, in this case, people who try to become experts in the field of behavior. It is, I would say, enough to know that the relation between structure of the brain and the problems in terms of cerebral palsy are not one to one. Now we are arrived at the neuropsychological functioning. So these children are most of the time, of course, also tested in a neuropsychological laboratory. And then the main finding, in general, is that 30 to 50% of the children have an IQ below 70. And also that the severity of the motor disorder is correlated with IQ. And what is also, let's say, generally speaking, find is a disharmonic profile. It means that the performance IQ is lower than the verbal IQ. What is verbal IQ? I think everybody can imagine what that is. Verbal abilities, it has to do with language. But performance IQ, it depends on the type of IQ test you use, but it has to do with insight in planning, and to measure the performance IQ, you need, let's say, blocks to put on a table, and when your motor system is compromised, you can imagine that the performance IQ is not so easily measured because of the motor problems people have. I come in detail to this issue in the next course of mine, starting in, I think, less than a month. So these are the main findings. Now then we have the crowding hypothesis. Why is it so that the verbal IQ might be greater than the performance IQ? Now, that is that after an insult of the left hemisphere, verbal functions becomes subserved from the right hemisphere. Now, that is one theory to explain such findings. Example of growing into the deficit. I have used that concept earlier, and the IQ drops or may drop as a function of development. That's why those cases are seen in the hospital maybe every year or every 2 years to see how the situation of the particular child is. Now, yeah, why is cognition so much of importance with respect to cerebral palsy? Well, it may determine the type of intervention, because when you have a lower IQ, not all the types of intervention may fit. Then, as a psychologist, you are most of the time also involved in educational decision-making. What kind of schooling is fitting for the children? And then also an IQ measure is, of course, handy to have. And then what to think about the quality of life. The more you are able to learn, the more you can adapt to environmental situations, etc. So cognitive research is needed in the field. Here you see the effect on the IQ with respect to the severity of the CP. Here we have a group of children who are able to walk. Here we have children who are able to walk, but they need assistant devices. And here we have people who are using a wheelchair. So this could be seen as an index of severity. Here you have IQ below the 70 and IQ above the 70. So you see that in the less severe condition, there is an overrepresentation of those having a higher IQ, whereas in the most severe condition, we see that children who are mentally retarded are overrepresented. But, of course, not everybody, because there is still a group of people who are using a wheelchair, but they could be, yeah, quite intelligent even. And here we see the disharmonic profile, that the verbal IQ is higher than the non-verbal IQ. And even when the IQ was in the normal range, then it doesn't mean that the language is intact. 60% of the children, as far as research we have carried out in Finland, have problems with naming objects. In 40% of the cases, there is a short memory span, oral motor problems, and articulation problems. So even in the normal range, we see that many people with CP have problems. And of course, motor behavior, when that is compromised, it also means the speech, language. When the IQ is delayed, then also the comprehension of the language is involved, which is logic, because then the children have a lower IQ, so the comprehension is also involved. And the other problems remain. So there is also a lot of research going on concerning the language abilities and to what extent the language abilities of people with CP is related to language disabilities as such, or language abilities in people with, for instance, Down syndrome, to see whether there are specific deficits in Down syndrome or specific language deficits in CP, because that may lead to specific interventions. Now we are arrived at the issue of interventions. And of course, we may think about the spasticity, that when you hardly can move your hand because it is really, you know, in one position and you can hardly change it. Those interventions are possible, but it is very hurting for the children. And another approach is that the interventions are related to routines of everyday life, mobility, self-care, social function, an issue like that. Also, which is a more modern view, is to involve also the caretakers in those interventions. Then horse riding. Children like that. And when you are riding a horse, you have to keep balance, which is, of course, a very essential intervention. And because children like this much more than the classical interventions, this, yeah, is an option. One dispute when we talk about interventions is the amount of time spent on therapy. Dutch research has shown 10, 15 years ago that many children are maybe too much involved in spending time on therapy, and as a result, they don't follow the normal education, which is not good. It is always good to, yeah, spend also time at school. And what do you think about participation? That is a very modern, I would say, term, expressing the need that people with, for instance, cerebral palsy are involved in our society, that everything is reasonable for them, that universities have special entrances, libraries, etc., etc. Well, this is not in all the countries the same, and that when they can find jobs, it is very good for them. Now we are arrived at the family studies as such, and I think it is wise to have a break of 4 to 5 minutes. People were asking that a few times ago, and I think it's a very good idea. See you back, and then we talk about family studies. 4 or 5 minutes. So I would like to continue. So we are arrived now on the topic of family studies, and it is focused on cerebral palsy. But when you are interested in these types of studies, parentoplegia or cerebral palsy or ADHD or autism, then many mechanisms I will discuss with you now are also applicable to those other groups of people with problems. And there are very good journals available. You can easily find in your library one of those journals is called Family Studies. What you read here is parentalplegia. It's a very old term, and it doesn't mean that parents have also CP, but it means that those who are working in the field as psychologists or doctors, that yeah, their behavior, their approach towards the families was not appreciated. The general idea was that all the parents are, let's say, poor in their, yeah, they are not handicapped themselves, but they are, let's say, pitiful. That is the right word I was searching for. And that was quite irritating because many families are doing well. So this is another example that, especially in the past, those patient groups were not happy with the approach given by workers in the field. And that is one of the reasons why all kinds of parent groups showed up. And they were nowadays so far that they can also initiate research by means of grants. They are able to give now and then. This said that many families are doing well, it is also true that the more severe a cerebral palsy is, the more stress might be experienced in the caretakers. This is especially the case when the child has multiple disorders. Think about lower IQ, think about autism or ADHD. And it's obvious that the more stress experienced by the caretakers, the more behavioral problems can be seen in the affected child. So those who are working in this field, they also must be keen on how the families are functioning. And yeah, there are also groups, parent groups, where people can share their ideas, their feelings about what happened, what is happening in the families, what it is meaning to taking care of such children. What could be at stake is, for instance, that people, especially women, feel guilty that they have delivered a child with all kinds of motor disorders, etc., etc. And yeah, that type of intervention might be of help to reduce the stress. There is a very good review article written with this person as a first author. It is a little bit dated in a top journal, Pediatrics. So for those who are interested, they can easily find it. And that research shows that many caretakers, they have back problems, migraine, headaches, stomach, intestinal, ulcers, asthma, arthritis, rheumatism, and they may experience pain. So these groups of parents, caretakers, have problems with respect to the situation. And they also are then in need of intervention. So what are the important factors when it comes to rearing children is, of course, the level of the IQ of the child, and again, the severity of the disorder. This is one of the studies we have carried out in Finland, and we were using a very simple, easy to fill in questionnaire meant for families. And here you can read all kinds of characteristics of the families: commitment, appreciated, time. What is meant here with time is, let's say, time spent together as man and wife, or families, other family members together, because you can imagine that when the time is eaten up because one of the family members is a child with CP, then less time goes to other families. Sense of purpose, so it may load on depression in the family. Communication. It could be the case that families have the tendency to isolate themselves. Role expectations. What is happening between the father and the mother with respect to the role expectations? Coping with the problem, etc. Flexibility, balance in the family. So here we have plotted, we have scored all kinds of essential characteristics of family functioning using the very simple list. And when the score is lower than 4, it may be that the family is scoring in the clinical range. And you can see here we have different in severity, which is plotted here when the IQ is lower than 70 or higher than 70, and when the motor performance is very worse in those children, here it's higher. This is an index of motor functioning. It's 1 against 3. And the black bar is the average of the two types of families. Then you can see that only with respect to internal coping, the families are scoring below the 4, especially those families rearing children with multiple disorders, which means that of all the characteristics, at least this sample of children were scoring low with respect to one characteristic: internal coping. So how to cope with the problem. And here, this is a more complicated figure. That's my experience when I discussed this with the students. Here we were using an a questionnaire which has to be filled in by one of the caretakers together with a social worker or a psychologist. And here, the behavior of the children is divided into three domains: self-care, mobility, and here, social functioning. And here we have the norm. So here, the group of children are scoring below the norm with respect to self-care, which is logic. The children have motor problems, so with respect to self-care, there must be a problem. Well, there is a problem because the children are scored lower than the norm. The same holds for the mobility, which is, again, logic, and it is an empirical finding. The children are scored lower than the norm. And here we have social functioning, which means reading, that children are playing, etc., etc. Also here, the children are scored lower than the norm. And here you see another line, and this is the amount of time caretakers are spending the time in helping, in serving, supporting the child with respect to self-care. And now you have to say it's more than the norm. So when we compare the children, it is less than the norm. And now here we are scoring the amount of time spent together with the children as far as self-care is concerned. And then you can say, well, the parents are giving a lot of time, more than the norm, with respect to self-care. The other thing is that the scores are very close together, which means that the more the child is in need of self-care, the more time is spent by the environment with respect to self-care. The same holds with respect to mobility. The more the children are afflicted, the more time is spent to help, to support the children with respect to mobility. But also when it comes to social functioning, you see that here there is a huge difference, which seems that in spite of the fact that children are in need of social functioning, less time is spent by the caretakers to take care of this function. So it means that those children may be quite isolated. The time that the caretakers are reading aloud is less, or the time spent to play together with the children is less. And our finding was also that there is special toys available. There are special toys available for playing with these children, and many parents hardly used these toys. When it comes to behavioral observations, not our study, but studies done by colleagues in Canada, for instance, it showed that many parents are not really talking with the children, but they are giving like in the military service, short commands like, now you have to eat. Now it's time to take your clothes and things like that. It's not really talking. So those children need more care of the caretakers with respect to social functioning. And I hope that those who are working in the field are keen on that. At the same time, it could be the case that this is so loading to support the children with the self-care, with the mobility, that parents are instinctively spending less time with the children to read aloud, things like that. Of course, when you are working in the field, you must not talk with the parents and using your finger like this, but simply this could be part of your attention. What are the recent questions? And that could be of importance when you are going to write a paper on this issue. For a very good review, I would refer to Rentink et al. 2007. And this is the name of the journal Child Care, Health and Development. And what are the recent questions? Well, one of the questions is, what is the effects on siblings? I was already pinpointing this issue when caretakers are spending the time to the child with CP, then there is less effect, there is less attention spent on brothers and sisters. When we were involved in this type of research, there were only two articles devoted to this issue. So I am very sure that now more research has been executed on the theme, what does it mean for siblings when the brother or sister of the family has CP? And then, who is in fact filling in those research lists? Well, I can tell you that in practically all the cases in all the research, the research questions are filled in by the mother, hardly by fathers. So you will read in most of that research that the amount of respondents was a few hundred, and 80%, 90% were mothers. So there is not so much insight in how fathers are dealing in the families with children with CP. This, by the way, holds for many disorders. And in the field of early child development, there was once published an article called "Where is Daddy?" So it is a general problem that those who are involved in the field, working in the field, like psychologists, psychiatrists, doctors, they are more, that their knowledge base is based on opinions of mothers, how the children are doing, less on the fathers. We did one research on this issue. Here we see scores of mothers and fathers. So we needed intact families. It could also be the case, by the way, that divorce could be the result of problems which are taking place in children. So here are intact families. And here are the domains: the financial domain, the emotional domain, the everyday assistance domain and the information domain. Information means the information given by the experts, those who are working in the field, towards the families. Everyday assistance, that is clear. Emotional is clear, and financial domain is also clear. And here you see the scores and the standard deviation, and you see the level of concordance. So what's the correlation about how mothers and fathers think about the financial domain, etc., etc.? And then you can see that especially when it comes to the emotional domain, the concordance between fathers and mothers is the least. And when it comes to the financial domain, the concordance is quite large between mothers and fathers. What is so important about the financial domain? Now, when the child is suffering from CP, then you have to change your whole house. You can imagine that. You have to change the toilet. You have to change maybe also the place where the child is going to sleep. Later on, you have to change maybe also your car, how to get in, how to get out. And mothers and fathers are agreeing. Again, when it comes to the emotional domain, then it seems, and only a few studies are available so far, that especially mothers have problems with coping, fathers to a lesser degree. And here, information domain, both mothers and fathers are not so satisfied with the information given by the hospitals. Why is that? Well, let's return to the issue of the kists, that there might be a relation between the amount and the location of the kists in the brain and the outcome. But do you know how many studies are available? Maybe 15 in total, at least when we were involved in this field. Very little studies so far have been executed wherein people like radiologists or child pediatricians are working together with, for instance, psychologists. And that psychologist is measuring, among others, the IQ level, the school achievement and things like that over time. So when those studies are hardly available, how can you then inform a family who has a young child suffering from CP? We hardly don't know what is the development. At best, something can be said about the motor development. But when it comes to cognition, then it is a domain which is really in need of a behavioral expert like you hope to become. So the fact that mothers and fathers are compared in their opinion, this is one study. Too little studies have done this, and that also may hold with respect to ADHD or autism, etc., etc. This really could be an interesting paper to write. To what degree are mothers and fathers differ with respect to a certain disorder? Now returning a little bit to a more formal part of our lecture again. And here you see the word neural structures. They might be compromised in people with CP. They might be compromised in people with ADHD, in autism, etc., etc. And it has its consequences for the cognitive functioning. Let's say to be more compromised at this level may has a negative effect on the cognitive functioning, which in turn may have its effect on what we call social participation. So here is a problem, and it goes to here. And then, of course, it goes backwards, because you know it now. There is an interaction between the social level and the structural level. It is not a one-to-one situation, but it is taking place. And when you improve this, or whether you improve this level by means of training, then it may have also its effect again on the development of neural structures. So this is a constructivist maturational model of psychopathology in children in general, and we used it because of cerebral palsy. So there is a problem at the neural structure. Children are isolated. That is what one of our studies is suggesting. Very little social interactions, and that may have, in this case, negative effects, but it also could have had positive effects. And here you read again, a multiple level approach to development of cognitive functions, and here the name Gottlieb. We have discussed this figure, this man, much earlier. Now we come to a second example of an interaction between medical status with the environment, and in this case, the IQ level of the mother. We did research on children who were born too early, prematuritas, that's the way we call it, and they were, let's say, reared in families, and the mother had a special characteristics, and we will discuss this later, but first of all, I have still 7 minutes. I would like to make a start about what does it mean, prematuritas. And this is the characteristic of the mother we will discuss probably during next week. Okay, the definition is quite easy. When we are using the birth weight, it means the child is born and you are simply measuring the IQ. And when the child is lower than 2,500 grams, then we talk about low birth weight. We can also have children with a birth weight of lower than 1,500 grams, and then the term is very low birth weight. And then we even may have children who are born with a birth weight of 750 gram to 1,000. Not all of the experts agrees with respect to this range, but anyhow, some of them are doing it, and I took this as a criterion, and these children are so-called extremely low birth weight. There is also another measure, and we call that the gestational age. So that is the moment when men and women were together and they were, let's say, meeting, and it could lead, of course, to an embryo in a few weeks, in a month. But you can imagine that this measure is not so valid, not so reliable, because not all the women are that precise. They don't know when they were menstruating for the last time, for instance. So at least the combination of the measures is used, and there are also laboratory hospitals where only birth weight is used as an index. Now, yeah, it may have many causes, low birth weight. Here we come again to anxiety and stress. We have discussed this earlier when we were talking about ADHD. Smoking is another one. And the low socioeconomical status is the strongest factor. So again, you see that this course is devoted to brain behavior, but you see how much importance the socioeconomical status is, even when we talk about brain and behavior. It might even be the strongest factor. I have told you this earlier. Children with low birth weight, they are more prone to hydrocephalus, to pentrifugal leukomalacia, cerebral palsy, we have discussed this, mental retardation, we have discussed this in relation to cerebral palsy, deafness, visual defects, and when the children are born too early, then it may even lead to death. In general, we may say that many children, not all, may develop at least minor disabilities, so a lower IQ, but in the normal range, mild motor impairments, poor memory language skills, and at least in the United States, 30 to 50% of the children very low birth weight in this case are following special education. We still have 2 minutes. Okay, I continue. I want to show you this. Now I introduce to you a new concept, risk mechanism. So prematurity is then seen as a risk factor. And then we have a mechanism, the environment. And we have talked this over and over. And now we are concentrating on one aspect, and that is the rigidity of the mother. And those who are interested in this type of research, Butcher is the first one, and my name you can find at the end, and it has been published. And we were interested in the development of the children with respect to IQ, with respect to motor functioning, when the children were 1 year of age, 3 years of age, and 7 years of age. And here we have birth weight. And here we have the rigidity as a trait, which means a state of the mother, but again, like in some other longitudinal studies we have carried out, the rigidity was not in the clinical case. It was simply a personality characteristic, like eating every Monday this type of food, going for a holiday to the same place time after time, this type of rigidity. Why rigidity? Because the more rigid, the less ability you have to deal with a child who is developing all kinds of problems, like ADHD. You can't stand all the developmental, all the changes the child is introducing time after time, because you could be rigid. Now, this is the last picture. This was a hierarchical regression analysis, and we took social economical class and rigidity, and also the birth weight into consideration. The social class didn't do so much because all the families were carefully selected. They all came from, I would say, the same type of socio-economical status, because of to reduce the amount of variance. And here you can see that there is a correlation between the rigidity of the mother with the outcome of the children when they were 7 years of age of minus 52, which means the more rigid the mother was, the lower the IQ. I went to a statistician and I said, what does it mean, minus 52? And then the statistician, he said to me, it means a difference of 10 IQ points. So this is an example. We have given now many examples of environmental factors about the development. And you could again consider cerebral palsy or autism to be a risk factor, and that the environmental factors, among others, rigidity of the mother, but there are more to mention, which are moderating the outcome. Next week, we continue with this lecture. Thank you very much for your attention. Bye-bye. See you next week.
Bye-bye.